Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, coming to you on heritageradionetwork.org, live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode 7, in which I am going to give you permission to eat full-fat dairy, ask the question, what is skim plus milk plus? Answer your listener questions, massaging a wedding registry to create a chef's kitchen, and whether or not you should pitch a scratched nonstick pan. That's pretty hard to say. I had a very eventful weekend this past weekend. My chickens have started laying eggs. Maybe just one or two of the birds, actually, out of 24. Well, 24 hens. I have 24 hens, and I have one rooster named Fancy Pants, because he has feathers that go all the way down his feet like bell bottoms. The beginning of laying eggs, for all intents and purposes, is chicken puberty. And on Saturday night, for some reason, the girls, who have been let out of their fenced run and every night since have no problem going back into their coop to roost, for whatever reason, decided to take up in the trees, which means if we let them continue doing that, it's only a matter of time until they are dinner to an owl or to a raccoon. So on Saturday night, it's getting dark. And it's starting to rain. And we, my family, my husband, holding our one-year-old, who should have been getting ready to go to sleep, he's holding him, and we are running around in the dark like crazy people, chasing chickens around with brooms and screaming and jumping around, trying to make ourselves big and scary to scare them back into the right place where they belong. The 2-foot by 1-foot door on the front of their coop that, for some reason, they were terrified of. And eventually we did get all but three back into the coop. Three of them stayed way up high in a cedar tree. And I was like, you know what? You're on your own, jerks. But they were still alive the next morning. So the next morning, before we could let the renegade birds who we had gotten back into the coop out, we had to catch the three that were now running around trying to figure out how to get food and water because they're on the wrong side of the fence. We had to catch them and clip their wings. And then we had to clip the wings of the other 20. We didn't clip the rooster's wings because he's not going anywhere. He knows where his girls are. The 24 hens total, we had to clip all of their wings. So they've only figured out how to fly out over the fence. They haven't figured out how to fly back. So this whole problem of having to open the gate at the end of the day was to let them back in because they can't figure out how to get back in again. So we pack a kid up in the stroller. My husband goes into the coop with a pair of kitchen shears, and I stay outside opening the little coop door one at a time when each bird has had her flight feathers clipped, which requires catching a chicken, which from the outside, you just hear this screaming birds like going crazy, and my husband trying to pin one of them up against the wall, and there's like 20 other birds in there watching him behaving like a maniac coming at them with shears. Now, it doesn't hurt them. It's like clipping fingernails or cutting your hair. And you only clip one wing because they lose faith in their ability to fly, whereas if you clip both wings, they just become stronger and better flyers. So you clip one and they kind of fall onto their side when they try to take off. So we're going through all of this. I'm laughing. The baby's laughing. My husband is not laughing. My husband is inside getting covered in feathers and poo and other gross chicken bits. And he says at one point, "Can I have a donut?" And I'm telling you this whole chicken anecdote because it sort of perfectly illustrates many, 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 our own included, our people's relationship with sort of quote-unquote bad food. Bad, you know, in quotation marks. Donuts aren't inherently bad, and we only eat them in our house once in a blue moon. And I'd like to say that that's because we have extreme self-control, but in reality, it's because we don't actually have access to really good donuts. If we lived in Philadelphia, anywhere near a Federal Donuts location, I'd be eating a halva donut on the regular. But we don't. And so finding, keeping ourselves from eating a lot of donuts isn't a huge hurdle because we don't have access to good donuts, so it's easy to say, sorry, no donut. However, we own our own deep fryer because I broke down and bought one after having a pot of oil sitting on the stove that I was frying in at least once a week, and it was taking up a pot, and I don't have a lot of excess pots because I have a pretty edited collection. And so for a couple of months of cooking in this pot once a week, I decided to use my husband's birthday as an excuse, and I broke down and bought a deep fryer for him. I mean, you know, it was his birthday present, and it's sort of on the auspices of being his birthday present, but it is definitely a gift for the house. So now we have a deep fryer, which means I'm one step closer to making my own donuts and following one of Michael Pollan's food rules. Michael Pollan, side note, who I heard on the radio Sunday night saying that he hasn't heard any compelling scientific evidence that leads him to not eat genetically modified food. I almost drove off the road. I said, Michael Pollan? Anyway, back to the donuts. This Michael Pollan food rule, which I'm paraphrasing, is pretty easy to follow. If you want a donut, you have to make it yourself. Or wait until you go to Philadelphia. But don't just run up to the Quickie Mart and waste your donut opportunity or like give in to your donut craving on a waxy, dreadful Entenmann's chocolate stale air cake. Like that's blech. That's not even a real donut. So it's easy for us to say, nope, no donut, even for us, even though we just caught 24 chickens, then cut 24 chicken wings and chased chickens out of trees all night in the dark, in the rain, all the while keeping our toddler alive. When I read that sentence back, it's like, I should have just gotten a donut. Well, you know, what I don't say no to ever, I never say no to full fat dairy or like whole fat milk. I've heard lots of people say, oh yeah, my favorite part about having a kid was getting to keep whole milk in the house, which is almost always said by a dude and almost always followed by, yeah, but now my wife is like, nope, sorry. And this pattern always makes my skin crawl. Like, can I correct this person? Like, how well do I know them? Or do I have to stop myself, like in the grocery store, when I hear someone looking for the quinoa? Look, it's none of my business if you and your shrew wife, or if your shrew wife won't let you have whole milk. That's your problem, right? Except I bet you're lying about the whole wife part. Most people are more than just a little bit vain. And it sounds annoying to say, oh, I don't buy whole milk anymore. It's like saying, I don't own a TV. Like, who wants to be that guy? So you blame your wife. She probably blames you. We, you know, have an understanding. And every morning you and your unsatisfying skim milk, you have your skim milk on your breakfast cereal and it's cloudy and sad. And you hate your morning every morning, longing for those days when you had a kid, because those extra 100 calories were delicious in your coffee, right? So why are we denying ourselves this thing that's only 100 extra calories, if that's what you're concerned about? Like, suddenly that's going to break your waistline. I think it's a combination of vanity and misinformation. I'm going to get the painful one out of the way first so that we can end on some proactive steps that are more easy to be like, yeah, okay, I can do that, and convince yourself that really drinking whole milk the way it comes out of a cow is the way to go. So here's the first rule, or the first thing. If your reason is vanity, if your reason for not drinking whole milk is vanity because you don't want to get fat, which I don't either, and I have a very firm no-fat husband rule, you cannot eat the whole Ben and Jerry's container. I know it seems like a single serving. I get it. I've been there. Believe me, more than one chunky monkey pint has been eaten in one sitting in my life. But that behavior cannot jive with your vanity. Same thing with like amazing, gooey, runny, stinky, sticky blue cheese that's as decadent as any New York Super Fudge chunk. You get to have a piece of it and you get to enjoy it. Having more baguette doesn't mean getting to eat the whole hunk of blue cheese that when you were buying it at Murray's, you were planning on keeping for a week. But because now you have extra baguette, you can say to yourself, oh, I'm just going to eat because I don't want the baguette to go bad. I'm just going to eat the cheese. But there it is. So runny and gooey and delicious. But then your vanity kicks in and you stop yourself. But those are easy, right? It's easy to be all like, oh, I don't eat all the Ben and Jerry's. I know that those containers are actually 4 servings. If you were eating something real and something whole that came from the earth or from an animal, very close to the way nature intended or exactly the way nature intended, you will tend to eat a lot less of it. So do this experiment at home out in listener land. Try eating a sugar-free cookie the next time you're craving something sweet and see how long it takes you to feel satisfied. Like put it in your mouth, chew on it, swallow it, and then kind of count the seconds. Like how long am I no longer wanting a cookie? Like, yeah, that craving has been satisfied. I'll save you the time. It's never going to happen. You can bully yourself away from the sweet, you know, the sweet craving, and you can have a skinny cow ice pop, whatever that is. And you can tell yourself, like, no, it was really satisfying. I'm really glad I had that 100-calorie pack of Oreo crisps with no cream. Or you can eat one amazing piece of something awesome. I'm currently obsessed with these malted milk balls that I got, and I get to eat one. And they're huge, and they're malt, and then they're covered in dark chocolate, and then they're covered in white chocolate, and then they're covered in this, like, orange infused white chocolate shell. They're so good. I eat one. That is the agreement that me and I have, and I'm satisfied immediately. I have to put the bag away in the other room because I could totally eat the whole thing, but I eat one and I am satisfied. So let's go back to the whole milk thing for a second that we are denying ourselves once we don't have little kids to thank. And this might be the best case of all for the whole milk, whole fat cheese scenario that I am giving you permission to go back to your significant other, say, no, you know what? Chef Emily said it's okay. Adult humans aged 17 to 90 need about 600 IU, which I looked up. That means international units when you see it on the vitamin bottle. 600 international units of vitamin D a day. And you can get this for, let's see. Reading the statistics. You can get this by standing in the sun for about 20 minutes, depending on where you live on the, you know, relative to the equator, the time of year, how light or skin your dark is, and you can't filter that with any sunblock. Easy in like the late spring, middle, or I guess maybe not the middle of the summer, late summer, early fall. When you're like walking around, gardening, whatever, laying in Prospect Park. But once winter rolls around, you're not going to stand outside for 20 minutes. And so now you have to get your vitamin D from another source. You can get it from dairy, the way Mother Nature intended. Now, get this. Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin, meaning that you have to consume a certain amount of fat with the vitamin D in order for your body to be able to absorb and metabolize the thing that you're trying to get into your system in the first place, so that you don't get cancer, depression, or osteoporosis. All three things are linked to low vitamin D levels. In 1 cup of whole milk, which is a serving as defined by the FDA, you get 124 IU of vitamin D, or 31% of what you need, based on a 2,000 calorie a day diet. And that can come from your cereal bowl, which you don't have to stand there hating with skim milk poured over your Cheerios. You want to know how much vitamin D you get from that same exact size serving of skim milk? None. Zilch. Not one international unit of vitamin D. Oh, and did I mention that you need a certain amount of vitamin D present to absorb any of that freely available calcium in your glass of milk? The calcium, which is equally present in both whole and skim milk, but not the vitamin D. Only vitamin D in whole milk. No vitamin D. No calcium absorption. A whole total waste of your cloudy bowl of cereal that you hate anyway. You're not getting the calcium from the milk anyway. So, that being said, no vitamin D, no calcium. Multiply that over a few thousand mornings, and this leads to the potential of an osteoporosis diagnosis, particularly in women. But don't worry, the pharmaceutical companies totally have you covered. Sally Field is hawking an injectable drug that promises to delay or treat osteoporosis. I see that during the daytime television when I'm vacuuming or doing whatever with my 1-year-old. She's talking to people who are in the demographic. So I went online to read those side effects that they race through really quickly. And you want to know what one of them is? In an osteoporosis drug? In the drug that promises to make your lifetime of denying yourself full fat milk totally worth it? Unusual bone fractures. In an osteoporosis drug. Thanks, Big Pharma. I will stick with my whole milk, and not because I have a little kid at home. I will continue to do it, even after he has left for college. Your questions after the break.
Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. Let it get sweeter by the day. But won't you save it, baby? Please save it. Come on and save it all for me.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson. This is the part of the show where I answer your listener questions. To send me a question, you can call 862-242-8599 and record your question into the voicemail. You can tweet me at Chef Emily P or find me on Facebook /Sharp and Hot. You can go to www.sharpandhot.com where all of those contact methods are listed for you in case you don't have a pen handy. Next week, I'm very excited about my special guest, who is a psychic medium who is going to come on and talk to me about food and the other side. I will save my ghost stories for next week, but suffice to say I have some. And he is going to be joining me to answer your listener questions. So if you have a question that has something to do with ghosts or food and funerary, like the things that we do when people die, like why do we bring giant amounts of lasagna to people or send baskets that have summer sausage in them? I'll tease one little ghost story. My husband's grandfather was known, he always had this tin of peppermints in his pocket, and I often, for no reason at all, am overwhelmed in the house where he lived with his wife and in front of the barn where he used to work, overwhelmed by the smell of peppermints and cigarettes, which apparently was what he smelled like. So I'm going to have a psychic medium on. He's going to help me explain some of this stuff. So you have questions. I have answers. Let's see. First this week, a question from Casey.
Hi, Chef Emily. This is Casey from Clifton, New Jersey. I'm getting married soon, and I would love your opinion on essential kitchen tools. I'd love to build my registry and get your best, most recommended kitchen tools and appliances on there. Thank you.
By the time I got married, I'd assembled a pretty good collection of kitchen stuff, and I kind of went back and forth on it, and ultimately we didn't even have a wedding registry because between us, we had mostly everything that one would register for. Which, side note, led to some awesome presents because it let people reflect on who you were as a couple, and it kind of gave us this insight into who people thought we were and what they wanted to give us as gifts. And no one bitched to me about not having any direction, as I had been warned that people were going to be upset that I hadn't provided them with any direction. If anyone was upset, they didn't at least bitch to me. And on top of that, everyone loves to give cash. So, but your question is about what would I recommend for kitchen tools? Number one, a really good food processor. Actually, I guess really good will apply to all of these, but the best one that you can afford to get. Although I will say I have this little 2-cup cheapo like food chopper that looks just like a miniature food processor that I found under the sink in my very first apartment. And so I have no way of knowing how old it is because I have no idea how long it was under the sink for, but I plugged it in and it worked and it still works perfectly. But don't take your chances. A high quality food processor will come, it'll come with an assortment of blades. And so that will be an indispensable tool. Number two, like a food processor, a really good mixer. I adore my KitchenAid. And not just for baking. They have a whole assortment of attachments for making ice cream or grinding your own meat or making sausages. Like you can buy a sausage stuffing attachment. I made the mistake. I'll save you the pain. I made the mistake of putting my attachment, the paddles and the whisk. The whisk was fine, but the paddle and the dough hook, I put them into the dishwasher and they lost their beautiful satin finish. But otherwise it works like a charm. Now they just look kind of like pitted metal, but they're fine. So yeah, don't do that if someone buys you a really beautiful KitchenAid. Number three, a really good blender. If you can find it or afford it, a Vitamix would be perfect. I love, love, love our Vitamix. It makes pina coladas and baby food equally smooth. But those are professional grade and the price is reflected accordingly. So if you're uncomfortable putting something that's $600 on your wedding registry, a blender of all things, then, you know, a lower name recognition would be totally fine. Better than Hamilton Beach, less than Vitamix is totally fine. Number four, a Le Creuset heavy bottomed cast iron enamel coated Dutch oven with a fitted lid. I know that you can get the Rachel Ray version at Home Goods for like $15, but I would not own that because Rachel Ray rubs my skin the wrong way. Le Creuset was opened in France almost 100 years ago in 1925, and they are beautiful and colorful and durable, and they're so functional, and you don't have to think, oh, Rachel Ray, every time you look at it, because you're going to have it for the rest of your life. You can think, oh, Northern France outside of Paris, Dover Sole in the English Channel, and not, oh yeah, she was on the Food Network when I was getting married. And the best part, all of these gifts to me, or all of these that I just listed were also gifts to me, even though I didn't get them as wedding presents. No, that's not true. The Le Creuset I got as a wedding present, but all of the rest of them, the blender and the, were all gifts because I have incredibly, incredibly wonderful, generous people. So if you have generous loved ones in your life and you aren't even getting married, you could just put a little bug in Santa's ear. I happen to have just walked by Broadway Panhandler, and there you can get all of their stuff online, even if you're listening to this in Michigan. They are having a Le Creuset clearance event. So it's not too early to start thinking about what you're going to stick under the tree. Okay, so that's my, those are my must-haves. Also, I guess a chef's knife. You could go back to the previous episode if you want my tips on chef's knives, but that's kind of a personal thing. I guess I probably wouldn't actually register for that. Okay, number two.
Hi, Emily. This is Emily from Petoskey, Michigan. I'm looking at my pots and pans. Some of them are called anodized nonstick pots. And it turns out their sealant is peeling. Is that really bad? Thanks. Bye.
My mother had us all terrified. Like the first sign of a chip in the nonstick coating when I was growing up, the pan went into the garbage. Or at least it was supposed to. I will say as an adult, and a chef, and a trained culinary professional who has worked in restaurants, I love my nonstick pan. And I have it for very specific tasks. There's a rumor out there that real, quote unquote real, or all caps, real chefs don't use nonstick. Well, I do. I'm a real chef, so suck it. For cooking eggs, it's the only way to go. Unless you have a beautifully seasoned cast iron pan that you're going to haul out every time you want to make a scrambled egg, or if you just love to scrape egg off your stainless steel with a coarse sponge, then by all means. I have my nonstick, and it works perfect for cooking eggs. And it's also great because it's almost always clean. Since I only use it for cooking eggs, it's almost never in the to-be-washed pile next to my sink where some of the stainless steel pans end up. Because, you know, I fired my cleaning lady, or if she went on permanent vacation or so, I don't know. But sometimes I don't get to washing all my dishes on the day that I use them. But yes, nonstick, eventually, they do all chip. Even if you are very diligent and you never use a metal utensil, which I know you never would, rubber spatula, wooden spoon, or the plastic utensils that the pan either came with if you got it as a set or that they sell right next to the nonstick pans. Interestingly, I just went to the store to replace my nonstick pan, which coincidentally were also wedding gifts, because they are chipping. And guess what? Nonstick, as we've known it, seems to be going away in favor of ceramic coated pans. So the question is, if you have nonstick hanging around, will the nonstick coating hurt you? According to DuPont website, the maker of Teflon, which is that nonstick coating, they say no, it's perfectly safe. The fluoropolymer used is called polytetrafluoroethylene, which even the American Cancer Society says that no, it's not suspected to actually cause cancer, which is the big fear that everybody has. One funny writer said that they just tell their kids that the black flecks are pepper. The bigger issue to me is that once the nonstick coating starts flaking, the parts where the stick has where it's flaked off, those bits that have now become pepper, it's no longer nonstick. So even if it wasn't going to make your face fall off or you're going to get cancer or, God forbid, osteoporosis, it's not doing the job that this pan was intended to do, and that alone is reason enough to replace it. I said earlier that I have a really good curated collection of pots and pans, and when it's not doing its job anymore, it gets pitched or sold at a yard sale, and then I wonder what I did with it. So let's see. Last week, I asked you what your favorite cookbook was and why. And I got a message on Facebook from Mike from Burlington, Vermont, who said, Mast Brothers Chocolate. Seriously, this book is out of control. The images are so good. I'm literally dripping with saliva. It's so good. And he sent me a picture of the cover of the book. So you can do that too. You can send me pictures. My current favorite cookbook, though, like I've said, I've got a whole bookcase of cookbooks, not just a bookshelf, is Ottolenghi by Yotam Ottolenghi. It just came out, and it is beautiful, and it is substantial. And he's got two other books, Plenty, which is all vegetarian, and Jerusalem, which won the James Beard Cookbook Award. I highly recommend them. They are accessible, and you can make recipes out of them, and he puts together flavor combinations that even I, as someone who uses unique flavor combinations pretty regularly, would think that I would come up with. There's this potato dish in Plenty where you make a caramel and then you put potatoes on top of the caramel and it becomes like this potato upside down cake with sun-dried tomatoes, and oh, it's so good. Also, I will give you my tip, which is I always take cookbooks out of the library before I buy them because I want to try a few recipes. And sometimes I find that they are just really filled with beautiful photography and the recipes don't actually work. The other thing about Ottolenghi's cookbooks is sometimes he has ingredients that are totally out there, like something called sea asparagus that you have to get from your fishmonger. But he gives you suggestions if you don't have access to that kind of thing. But yeah, go to the library, take out the cookbooks that you think you want to buy first and try them. And then you'll know, am I buying this because I want the recipes? Or am I buying this because I like the celebrity chef or the not celebrity chef? Am I buying this because it has beautiful photography? And it's going to live on my coffee table. So that brings me to this week's question of the week. Does food porn photography with beautiful styling and beautiful lighting and everything's just so perfect, either like perfect stainless steel or just mismatched enough wooden spoons. Does that kind of photography make you more or less likely to try cooking something out of a book or out of a magazine? Or do you find that the super polished photography is intimidating? And you're like, oh, it's never going to look like that. I'm not even going to bother. Where's the blue box of macaroni and cheese? Send me your answers. 862-242-8599. Tweet me at Chef Emily P. Find me on Facebook.com/sharpandhot. Don't forget, next week, psychic medium Craig McManus will be here to talk food and the other side just in time for Halloween. Until then, I am Chef Emily Peterson. You are listening to Sharp and Hot. Keep playing with fire. Keep playing with knives. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.